take that ridiculously and say, I'm going to give up automobiles. Ah, that's crazy. You design safer cars, you design safer highways, and you continue using automobiles because we get a huge benefit out of it. However, the township of Oyster Bay, if they're at the national average, 35 people per year die in that township because of vehicular accidents. 35 people per year. Maybe it's 33, maybe it's 32, maybe it's 36, you know what I mean? On average, if they're at the national average, how many of those people will survive or not survive if the first responders are rolling toward them in the first minute? With cell phones and other kinds of communication, you can dial 911 and emergency services are rolling toward your accident where you just hit a telephone pole and you're sitting there bleeding and maybe you're going to die. And if those first responders get there in the first couple of minutes, your chances of survival are drastically higher. Some number of those 35 people that will die will survive if you have the right radio equipment. It's life and death. You can say, I want to live a simple life. I want to go back to the old, good old days. And I don't want this radio equipment in my town because it looks ugly and I think it's dangerous. That is a lethal decision. You don't know it. It's not direct. But people will die when you make that decision. Black and white. If you have any understanding of statistics of variables like this, we're discussing how many people will or will not survive. Yes, the education is needed. Mel, the third time I try to get back to you. K2KUI, I know you've got a couple of subjects you want to discuss. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Paul wants to make one more comment about the rover. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Mel. Just one quick comment. Believe me, I think what you're talking about right now is very important. That I'm not going to hold you. But there is another, there's a new book out, this fellow Jim Bell. He was in charge of the cameras with the rovers. And saw him on C-SPAN. And he's a very good talker. And he's had to pick 150 pages, 150 pictures out of the 150,000 pictures that the Mars rovers had sent back. And he's got it in book form now. During his talk, he talked about the pressure that they were under when they were trying to build one rover. NASA came up to him and they said, you know, there's a risk factor in here. We might lose one of the rovers. How about building two rovers? This question was posed to Steve Squires in charge of the whole thing, the guy that you mentioned. And he said, well, you know, Steve, in about a microsecond, he said, okay, no problem. The problem was, because Mars only comes around, you know, every 27 months it lines up with Earth, and their time frame cannot change. Whatever their time frame they had left, now they had to complete two rovers within one. So that's how busy this group wound up, Dick. It's quite a story. So he does have a book out. I didn't get the book yet, so I can't give you a product review on that, but it's probably pretty good. Back to you, Dick, and I'll listen to this interesting topic. I did read the articles, as many people did with the in Newsday, and they did mention a little blurb about amateur radio being involved with radio waves, microwaves. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yes, Steve Squires and the people building two of those had a deadline like no other. Mother Nature can make some extremely severe deadlines. When Mars is going to go by and you've got to launch at the right time to have enough energy to get there with your spacecraft, it's a very critical maneuver. You don't want to miss that bus. In high school, you miss the bus because you're staying after school, you're involved with a sports, an extracurricular activity, and you take the late bus and you get home. NASA couldn't miss that bus. You either launch within that window of a couple of days or forget it for the next 2.5 years and just have the hardware sitting there aging. And some hardware, when it sits and ages, terrible things happen. So, what a success story. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Just a couple of words on this. As far as the contactors go that they're using on the solar panel system, I'm not surprised that they have rotary joints like that, because for many years, you know, these cranes that they use in New York City that sit up on top of the pedestals materials for these skyscrapers, they're electric cranes, and they have the ability to turn 360 degrees, and they're doing it all day long. Of course, they're not drawing anywhere near the amount of current, but they are small contactors that I understand are bronze contactors, and they're capable of running the 10 horsepower electric motor that's aboard the crane. So I'm sure that they just took this and they were able to make one much larger to handle a lot more current, but I assume that there must be a reliability in those type of devices that they use up there in the crane, because the crane stops working and the building job stops. So I'm sure that to service it and take the whole crane down and all would be quite a project. So I'm sure there's reliability in that type of system of using bronze contactors. One more thing, there was a program on the other night called the Wired. First time I ever saw it on PBS, called Wired. And particularly I wanted to watch it because they had a guy on and calls himself the Media Hunter. He goes around looking for meteorites, and he sells them to museums and collectors. And in fact, he sold one, he showed it was about 1,200 pounds of meteor that he dug up, and he said he got $1 million for it. And when he brought it up, he raised his media, he had it there, he put a magnet to it, and it stuck. And I was just curious, is all meteorites that have fallen to Earth have an iron contact? In other words, if I went along the beach, right here, a lot of stones wash up on a beach. I'm sure meteorites have fallen into the ocean here at times. If I went along the beach with a magnet and I found a stone that sticks to that magnet, is it possible that I found a piece of a meteorite, Dick, over?
I don't think you can use that as a great criteria, Mel. There's a lot of stones on Mother Earth that are mildly magnetic, and some significant percentage of meteorites are magnetic. You're asking, are they all magnetic? I don't know, but I'm doubtful. I'll bet you a certain percentage of the meteorites are not magnetic. There is good reason to believe that most of the water that's on planet Earth came from meteorites. So those meteorites definitely gave us amino acids, the basic building blocks of life, and water, among many other minerals. So I think we got to research that one further. I doubt you could use that as a way of saying that one is a meteorite and this one is not. I may be wrong. You can see I'm doubtful. Back to you, Mel.
Well, he's finding him by using one of these metal detectors. He made a large metal detector. I'm sorry you didn't see the program. He's got this large metal detector he made with a PVC pipe. It looks like maybe about 6 or 7 feet square. And he drags it on wheels. He drags it behind him on a little RV. And he's got this, the electronic detector unit sitting on a sort of like a thing around his neck, and he with a pair of headphones on, and he said, "Oh, here's a meteorite." And they went and they dug it up, and sure enough, they dug up a 50 pounder. And they said, "Are you sure this is a meteorite?" And the first thing he did is took out a magnet, and he put it right up against it, and it stuck. He said, "See?" He says, "This is a meteor." Because this is the way he finds it. So I say, if he's using a metal detector to find meteorites, I would assume that they all have a high iron content, Dick, over.
Okay, if you told me that a high percentage of the meteorites have metallic materials, and that's the main thing that your surveying device, not your survey, you know what I mean, these treasure hunting things that you buy, the main thing they can detect most easily is metal. Copper, silver, zinc, steel. Copper is not magnetic, but you can pick up copper very well with these metal detectors. They're called metal detectors because they detect metal. Magnetic and non-magnetic. I don't know. You, Mel.
Do you want to?
Go ahead, Paul.
I saw the show. I saw that show. Great show. It had a lot of good topics, Mel. And I agree. If you go out in the middle of the desert, wherever this guy was, he looked like he was in a big field somewhere. Chances of somebody going out and putting a big rock, I mean, this thing was like 50 pounds, 3 feet under the ground, and digging it up and just saying, well, this is from Mother Earth, and, you know, it's all by itself. It's most likely a meteor, and I think that's what they're basing it on. Whether they do other studies or not after that, they really didn't say, but, yeah, anything like heavy iron like that is, the magnets will stick, and metal detectors will pick up anything, you know, aluminum or whatever. In fact, the other day, I had a new wallet for Christmas. Any store I walked into, I was beeping, but I didn't know why I was beeping. Unusual, you know, I had other new things on. Maybe it was something else. But I took my wallet apart at home. So that seemed to be the only problem. Long story short, I figured, well, let me take a look. Put a magnet next to it. Take everything out, credit cards, everything. Put a magnet. Nothing happens. I took my metal detector, same things that you walk around in the backyard with or on the beach with, and I put that, and that thing went off blasting loud. In the material of this wallet, I didn't cut it apart because I returned a wallet, but you could feel there was a card there. And Dick, you probably know about this. I think you've talked about it. I think it was an RF detector. My guess, it was probably made to go to Germany or some other country that has these things already going, and somehow this one wound up in the States because you couldn't remove this thing. But yeah, the detector picked that up, and a magnet did nothing with it. Same with the meteorites. You know, you'll find something like that, dig it up, and the guy put a magnet near it, and right away, oh yeah, this is a meteor. Mel, I want to dig a couple of these up. Did you see the prices they were going for? Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to RFID tags that are now being put into passports, the RFID tag can have 98 bits or even more bits of information, which can be read very well on your passport. However, you don't want unauthorized people reading your passport when it's in your pocket. So the two halves of the passport have a sheet of metal that when it's closed against the RFID tag and essentially kills the tag, unless you put an extremely strong field nearby. And that would be hard to make as a portable piece of equipment. So by having those sheets of metal in the covers of your passport, it is safe until you open it. And then you open it and present it when it's proper, because you have to present your passport. So maybe your wallet was being made for some reason like that. RFID tags are starting to find their way into credit cards. And so if you're on a subway train and somebody's got the right kind of equipment and he puts it against your pocket in your pants, in theory, he can read the RFID tags that are, he can read some of the information that's in the credit cards in your pocket if it's got time. And so if your wallet has got that sheet of metal, it protects you. So maybe you've got a very modern wallet there. What do you think, Paul?
That went back. It was a great wallet. I brought it back. I got another one identical to it. I could feel it. I knew what to feel for, and I felt, well, there's nothing in there, and sure enough, I don't beep every time I walk in or out of a store. And I wonder if Mel watched that show long enough to watch the rocket packs, how far that they've developed. That was a great part of that that show as well. Pretty exciting technology. They really haven't come that far in the last 40 years. They had a lot of good scenes, though. Good show. PBS, of course. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, what was the brand name on that wallet that had that piece of metal in it?
Dick, I don't remember. I can find my box for the new one that I got and take a look at it. I don't know the name offhand.
Okay. Mel, you've got it.
Roger, he's got one of those wallets. I saw it in the Sharper Image. They have it. They tell you it detects your vital information on your credit card that can be easily detected with the right instrumentation. And this is a new wallet that protects the your information in that wallet. That's what you got there, Paul. I saw it in a sharper image. Yeah, I saw all that on that program with those backpacks and everything. The only thing I can say, I saw that guy finding media rights and selling them for ridiculous prices, $1 million for a piece of stone, a rock that he said fell from the sky. And the way he was showing, he proves it, was, I can say, this is what I picked up on, was he sticking a magnet on, and it was sticking to these rocks. And that's how he finds these rocks. That was out in Kansas. He was found that one in Kansas that they dug up. It was 7 feet down, 7 feet below ground, and it was about 40 or 50 pounds of rock. And when they pulled it up out of the ground, that's when he stuck the magnet with it. They say, see, I told you this was a meteorite. And, okay, anyhow, Dick, you know where the problem lies? We're talking about, you know, antennas and everything. The word radiation. I've said this over and over again. They tied radio to radiation, and that's where the problem is. And to show you how bad it is, years ago when microwave ovens started to become regular appliances in your kitchen, they were coming out with these little boxes that they were selling. Oh, I saw them in all the different magazines. A radiation detector to tell how much radiation is coming out of your microwave. They all were marked radiation detectors. And there you are. That's it. Radio and radiation got tied together many years ago. And there's where the problem is. The word radiation should never have been tied to radio, Dick, over.
You're absolutely right. It should be called radio emission, radio transmission, radio signaling. It was a perfectly good word in 1900 because the signal does go out in essentially all directions. That's called radiating, and the process of doing that is radiation. Perfectly good word as far as the dictionary is concerned. I don't think the radio people caused the problem. World War II and nuclear devices caused the problem. All of a sudden you had nuclear radiation and radioactive decay of radioactive substances. And so the words got bollocked up together. So World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and modern day nuclear power stations, that's what caused it. The word radiation was a good word. By the same token, back in 1929, the word depression and recession took a flip to bad things happened to the economy in 1929, and we called it the Great Depression. Depression means to push something down. People didn't want to admit how bad it was, so they used a kind word, depression. Recession means to go backwards. Recession is a hell of a lot more severe by dictionary definition. But because of 1929, we got those two words reversed. Recession now is okay. Depression is bad. Craziness. Back to you, Mel.
To overemphasize what you just said, for many years, if you bought an electric heater, which is just, you know, just one of these element heaters, they would, and many of them were marked radiation heater. In other words, they radiated the heat into the room from these elements. You don't see that now. The only way they're ever marked, you'll never see the word radiation on them, Dick. If you look, now they're electric heaters, over.
Yep. We develop a fear of certain words. They take on an emotional meaning. And I think the top of the list of words that people get emotional about, for good reason, is the word cancer. But reasonably far up on that list is radiation. And as long as people are talking about nuclear radiation, which is accumulative, and it's these microscopic bullets that come flying out of that substance at the speed of light, and they hit you and they do damage, yes, that is nuclear radiation. But RF radiation, which is really an RF wave, is nothing but heat when it hits a human being. For 50 years, all those best universities, best laboratories, best institutions, best experiments worldwide have been looking for the non-thermal effect. They haven't found it. It's only a wave. out food with RF energy in a microwave oven. It doesn't do anything but heat. And you have an extreme amount of that heating in a microwave oven. You have less than 1 millionth of that when you're at the maximum exposure with RF energy. And it doesn't do anything but heat. So we tolerate it in our food, but 1 millionth of it we won't tolerate on our body, even though it's 1,000 times weaker than what happens when you get into the sun. Are we going to give up sunlight? Of course I'm being silly here. It is a strong misunderstanding. It's a huge educational problem, like you said. We're the one people per 500 in the general population, the ham radio operators, who have the knowledge, who work with it day to day, and it doesn't do anything bad to us, and just listen to us. You know what I'm saying. I hope some sanity comes about. I'm a little worried. To take millions of dollars from Homeland Security and say, take it and blank, take that money and shove it, is essentially what they're saying. Not in my town, not in my backyard. And now that you've asked to make improvements of the antennas that I already have that are inadequate, now I know they're there, and now I want you to eliminate them entirely. I want to step back into the 20th century. I don't want to be in the 21st century. That's foolish. K2KUI, K2RIW in the TechNet.
How about the MRIs, Dick, WS2N?
Yeah, it used to be nuclear magnetic, nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. The word nuclear, I guess that's up there with radiation. Nuclear. Almost as bad as cancer. Nuclear. Oh, that's bad. And some of our presidents don't know how to pronounce it. Maybe I'm one of them. So now it became MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. The exact same thing. Got to be careful with what you call it. I was told that at one time, in order to give things a nice friendly words, nice friendly title, an atomic bomb was called a troop immobilizer. In order to give it a nice friendly spin. Politically correct English. Boy, you can have a lot of fun with that. You got it, Mel.
And your life insurance speech, I like that one too, Dick.
Yeah, it's really death insurance. But it wouldn't sell as death insurance. That's what it really is. But you give it a positive spin, life insurance. Gotta be politically correct about all these things. We call each other gentlemen. We should call each other gentle persons. Gentlemen is a sexist remark. You got it, Mel.
Okay, final words on it. There was a case in New York of a tenant wanting to break a lease in an apartment building that had installed above him. He's up in the top floor, installed above him cellular phone system antennas. And believe it or not, the court upheld that he was able to break the lease because they put in cellular antennas up on the roof above his head. He refused to live there and used that as his excuse for breaking the lease, Dick. And the court upheld it. Would you believe it? Over.
There are courts all the time making mistakes. There is now a federal mandate. You cannot deny the siting of a cell phone base station because of the perceived threat of RF radiation. You can deny it for aesthetic reasons, property values, strength of the building, strength of the structure, physical reasons, but you can no longer do that. A person who's smart enough can take you to federal court and get that decision reversed. So the federal government, after 50 years of study, has come to the conclusion that we keep doing this study over and over again in each individual town. Are those antennas safe? And are our children being exposed unreasonably? You ask all of your friends, would they buy a desirable house that is right next door, the adjacent piece of property, to a cell phone base station? 99% of all those people will say, no way, Jose, I wouldn't touch that with a 2,000-foot pole. 99% of your friends would never park their family next to a cell phone base station. Now, if you made the decision because you don't like the looks of it, I can sort of understand that. But when you put that cell phone against your head, because it was a quarter of an inch or a half inch away from your head, by the inverse square law, 1 million times more RF energy goes into your head when you operate that cell phone by comparison to living directly next door to the cell phone base station. And if in your town you insist on not having any cell phone base stations, not only will your cell phones not work very well there, but when they finally do get working at all, you get picked up as a rover in Connecticut, and you pay a roving charge, and the cell phone is a power-managed system. The base station is continuously telling it, go up, go down, to adjust for the right amount of power. When it has to talk over to Connecticut, it goes to maximum power. It has no choice. That kills the battery faster. It makes it physically run hotter in your hand, and it puts more RF energy in your head. And you have a whole lot of dead spots in the town. So you only lose three times in a row if you insist that there'll be no cell phone base stations in your town. On top of that, because of that decision, people will die. Other than that, it's a pretty good decision. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I guess we can talk about this subject indefinitely, and things will just not really change. Very hard to educate the public, and I see that. It's like you say, old cliche, banging your head against the wall. I guess you don't have any information in front of you about that receiving loop, so I guess we'll discuss that maybe next week if you get a chance to take a peek at that receiving loop, because there's a couple things I'd like you to peruse, as they say, over in the article about the formulation and all and the theory behind what this gentleman who designed it came up with and why and where. But I'd rather you see the article before, you know, we get any further into it, Dick. So we'll leave that for next week. As far as emails, getting back to ham radio, continue with Limark's Ham Radio University here. I got a number of emails, and they thanked us very much for going through all the Smith chart different applications of it very slowly. You know, in other words, don't jump to, you know, actually explain every move, why we did this and where and how and, you know, what the math was. And a couple of them asked me, they said they've seen a number of antennas that the manufacturer shows diagrams, these circles with equally spaces on it, and they mentioned that show resistance and angle, measured some kind of angle, they said, and along the way and all, and they wanted to know really what that is. So I think what they're really talking about is polar form, putting into polar form, polar notation thing. So I thought maybe I would say a few words about that tonight, over.
Yeah, I'm going to try to, on your first subject, I'm going to try to remember to bring home my antenna engineering handbook, my ARL antenna book, which is at the salt mine. I've got two more of them in the house, and I went looking for them during your talk of about 45 minutes ago, and I couldn't find one. So either I've loaned them to people, I put them in the wrong place, maybe the wrong side of the bed, and I read it before I go to sleep at night. I didn't find it. Now, when it comes to representing signals that have a real component and a reactive component, or signals that have an amplitude and a phase, amplitude and phase can be represented pretty nicely on a polar chart. But a polar chart doesn't allow you to easily make calculations when you put things together, like an antenna with a little bit of standing wave ratio on a feed line, and you're matching two different kinds of feed line, putting them together. A polar chart doesn't do that very well. If you read Marino's book, Microwave Transmission Systems, Theodore Marino, 1948, beautiful paperback book, and sometimes you can buy it used for a pretty nice price. Very well done book. He shows you the things that came before Smith and after Smith. Before Smith, there was a kind of a rectangular chart with elliptical circles on it that tried to represent a reactive component and resistive component in a way that you could make calculations with it. And when you go to the very next chapter and you see the great advantages of Mr. Smith's chart looks a little bit like a polar chart. but it really isn't. All the lines on the Smith chart are always hitting each other at right angles. Everywhere in the chart, wherever two lines touch, with the exception of just that one point out there at infinity, all lines always touch each other at exactly 90 degrees. And there's a lot of magic in that. And so you can read, if you want, the mathematical development. Don't have to. Learning how to use it is a very useful tool. It's a lot nicer than just buying somebody's piece of software, plugging numbers into it, and pray you get the right answers. Because there's mistakes in programs, and there's a lot of ways you can make mistakes in the way you put data into the program. You can use centimeters when it wants meters, and you can use hertz when it wants megahertz, and so on. So be able to have a backup technique with a Smith chart, a handheld calculator, the back of the envelope if you're smart enough just to come up with ballpark figures, order of magnitude. There's great advantage in that. So I think you're saying some of this was at Ham Radio University, and I think you're saying you've gotten some emails because of the questions that arose there. And I was busy today. I would have liked to have gone. And I had a depressing day, in fact, a big business meeting that didn't go well. Oh, well, can't win them all. Were you at Home Radio University, and are you getting emails because of that? Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
This is the W2VL repeater.
Oh, I didn't go to Ham Radio University. Also, I got in very late last night. Yeah, I sympathize with you. I've gone through that situation many a time. I just have to say, chalk it up to experience. But no, last night I had both a meeting yesterday in New York, and then the XYO, we got together with another couple, and we socialized and came home pretty much 3 hours in the morning, as they say. What I got is emails. They want to know, you know, basically how they derive this angle business and all. As I say, they refer to it as referring to polar form or polar notation. And I thought I'd just touch upon, you know, what polar notation is. Basically, you know, when we talk about the polar notation, we're basically talking about similar to what we've been doing with the Smith chart. And but in this case, we're measuring magnitude impedance, what they call magnitude impedance, that's the resistive, and the phase angle. Sometimes they also refer to scalar. Measurements. So if I'll give you a little, I figured they'd ask for a little demonstration of going to polar, how the measurement that we've been taking can also be converted from what we were doing, rectangular, to polar. So a little demonstration I thought I would give of that, Dick, to solve the you know, their problem of understanding how you convert one to the other. Over.
A good thing to do. Anything to do with phase does mystify a significant portion of the engineering community. So whenever you've got an alternating voltage, doesn't matter if it's the 60 cycle power from Con Ed or the 50 hertz power from London Power and Light or the 1.8 megacycle signal you've got at 160 meters, or the 10 gigahertz signal that I like to use. Whenever you've got an alternating current signal, if you're smart enough, no matter where you measure it, it always has an amplitude and a phase angle by comparison to something you call reference. So there's always an amplitude and a phase angle. I send out a radio signal into my transmission line. It goes up to the antenna. The antenna is not a perfect 50-ohm resistor. Some amount of that energy reflects back. When it comes back to your antenna tuner measures the amplitude. That tells it how bad the bezoar is. And it measures the phase angle. That tells it which way to grind its capacitor and inductor when you've got an automatic antenna tuner. So there is a phase angle and a magnitude of every single alternating current wave. Sometimes you don't care. I mean, when you're lighting up a light bulb, you don't really care what phase angle is the 60 cycle power going into that light bulb. It's only the magnitude that counts. Is it a 100 watt light bulb? Am I drawing 1 ampere? But in reality, that light bulb has a little bit of inductance, and there is a phase angle there. There's a phase angle to everything. Con Ed will dictate that if you're running your factory and making a significant phase angle of the load to Con Ed, because you've got rotary machinery, and you've got inductors that are doing heating and whatever, that lowers the efficiency of the Con Ed power line, and if you don't correct it, they're going to charge you a penalty. And in many cases, you buy a whole bunch of these great big capacitors, and you put them across your power line in your factory to make it more capacitive, because you started off too inductive, because you got a lot of motors, rotary machines, that are making an inductive load. And Con Ed wants you to be a pure resistance. So in every situation, there is a phase angle. The most important phase angle to us amateurs is, what is the amplitude and phase angle of that signal that comes back to my antenna, from my antenna to my antenna tuner. If it's a lagging phase angle compared to my reference, the transmitter, we say that my antenna looks like an inductor. If it's a leading phase angle by comparison to my reference, the transmitter, we call it the capacitor. My antenna looks capacitive when I look into the feed line in the shack. So polar is a representation of amplitude, that's how big the arrow is, and phase angle, which means is the arrow at 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4:30, and so on. Those are phase angles. 6 o'clock, for instance, happens to be the 180-degree phase angle point on most polar charts, and that's the one point where it doesn't matter if you call it 180 degrees lead or 180 degrees lag. At one point, they're both the same place. A little bit similar to what happens with a thermometer. Minus 40 degrees centigrade and minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit are the exact same point on a good thermometer. So minus and plus 180 are the same point. Plus 90 and minus 270 are the same point. But the numbers come out identical with 180. So although many of us have trouble with phase angle, a little bit of work with a polar chart and reading the right book, and I hope you can suggest the right book. I can't. It'll help. Maybe I took some of the wind out of your sails. Sorry about that, Mel. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Help to clarify it quite a bit, I'm sure, for everybody. This is K2KEY. I was just basically going to demonstrate from what we did previous on one of our measurements that we applied to the Smith chart. And the measurement we made with an RX noise bridge at the time was 40, resistor 40 plus J30. And that, of course, would be, we plotted that. We used rectangular form. Remember, we normalized it. We plotted on the Smith chart. Now, as Dick would just said, if you wanted to convert that over to read the magnitude and the phase, because at times, if you notice that, as Dick said, as the angle increases towards the 180, the SWR actually will be on the same antenna, will also be increasing. So basically, if we took that measurement, that was 40 plus J30, that's what they were asking, and I wanted to put it into polar form. We call it the polar form. All right, so what we'll do, to give you a demonstration of that, a simple demonstration. If you draw a horizontal line on a piece of paper, about an inch and a half long, a horizontal line, and then erect a vertical line, about an inch and a half vertically, where the two lines come together, we'll call that point O. Now, along the horizontal line, if you take your ruler, pace off quarter-inch spaces, all about six of them down the line, quarter-inch spaces. I'll give you a second to do that. And now also you do the same thing with the vertical line. I know a lot of people record it. I said that's what they do, that you should record it and then play it back and repeat the processes that we've been giving for, you know, things like the Smith chart and all. And they said because they like it to go slow. All right, so now that you got this lines, these little dots along the both the horizontal and vertical line, quarter-inch spaces, just right next to it, quarter-inch space, each quarter-inch space equals 10 ohms. All right? Next thing, now let's take that measurement of 40 plus J30. Now along the horizontal line, between O going out to the right or whatever, the horizontal line, mark that R, that's our resistance, our line that we're going to plot resistance. The line that goes up vertically, that'll be our X, that's going to be our reactance. So now we measured 40 plus J30. So let's go four boxes over on the horizontal line to represent 40 ohms resistive. Let's go up on the vertical line from O, three boxes up, and we'll represent that as 30 ohms reactive. Now let's draw a dashed line from 30 ohms horizontally, and then draw a dashed line from the 40 ohm point vertically. So where the two lines come together, the two dashed lines, you go up, and where they come together, mark that point P. Now, take your straight edge now and draw a straight line between O and P. Okay? That represents our vector line. Now, to do the mathematics of this, the relationship of Z, the impedance of the ohmic impedance of this, our Z that we want to determine, we will use the formula Z equals the square root of the reactance squared, R squared, the resistive squared, R squared, plus the reactive squared, X squared. Again, I'll repeat that. Z equals the square root of R squared plus X squared. So now if we substitute into our formula, Z equals square root of 40 squared plus 30 squared. We do the math, square root of 1,600 plus 900 will equal square root of 2,500, which equals 50 ohms. So that line between O and P, we'll call that line Z for zebra, it's 50 ohms. Now, what's the angle? Well, to find the angle of that, we can take the tangent. The tangent of the angle is equal to the reactance over the resistance. So tangent of the angle will equal X over R. Or, stated this way, tangent to minus 1 of 30 over 40. So we do the math again, and we find that 30 over 40 will yield 0.750. And the tangent of minus 1 of 0.750 will equal 36.875 degrees. So that is how they derive that in polar form. We've got 50 ohms with a angle of 36.87 degrees. Okay, any questions about it? This is K2KEY.
And by the way, these rectangular form, when you draw those triangles, it's always a right triangle. By Mill making the vertical 30 and the horizontal 40, he was sneaking in a so-called 3-4-5 right triangle. 30 ohms of reactance, 40 ohms of resistance, 50 ohms of hypotenuse, 50 total ohms. It's a 50 ohm circuit at some particular phase angle. It really was a 3-4-5 triangle. Very crafty. You got it, Mel?
WB2HWW, real quick, Dick.
Go ahead, Howie.
Isn't it 53.1 degrees? Isn't it 3-4-5, 53.1, 4 over 3?
It's 3 over 4. It's reactance over resistance. It is 36.86989. Call it 36.87. I agree with Mel on this one, Howie.
Okay. I don't know why I'm saying 53 degrees. I know it might be 4 plus 3, because I know you can do it either way. Okay. If you reversed, it would have been 53 degrees, correct?
Yes, and then you're taking the angle from the vertical versus horizontal. Most people use the reference horizontal. Your answer is also correct as long as you're using a vertical line reference, and as long as you keep all of your calculations that way, you can make it work. Back to you, Howie.
Well, that's the way I used to do it. You take the real, you take, if it was x squared plus y squared, take the square root of that, and it's y over x.
Most of the schools I know about, Howie, teach x over y, reactive over resistive for measuring phase angle. Some schools do it the other way. By the same token, when it comes to which direction does current flow, some people think current's the movement of positive charge. Some people think really electrons are flowing, so it's a movement of negative charge. So when they put the arrow on the diagram, current flows in the other direction in some schools. That's a very rare school, but I think if you and I do some web searching, we'll find out that reactance over resistance, inverse tangent, is the most popular way of measuring angle. You measure angle with reference to real. People are more familiar with real. Real is more desirable. If you do a good job, your whole circuit is real, and there ain't no reactance, per se. So referencing to real is more popular, and to some people makes more sense. Back to you, Howie.
Well, all right, I got to go. All right, no argument. I just wanted to make that comment, WB2HWW.
You're right. You just have the other school there, Howie. That portion of Brooklyn apparently does things a little differently. You got it, Mel.
This is the only way. This is the way it was put also in college-level engineering, Dick, that reactance over resistance. And like you say, with reference to the horizontal line. I believe that this is the most straightforward way of going from rectangular to polar. Am I correct, over?
Without a doubt, that is the right way to do it. However, if you've got a Hewlett-Packard 28S and you've got open parentheses 40 comma 30, close parentheses, and you go to the complex page and there's an R arrow P, which means rectangular to polar, you press that one key and it all happens in a microsecond. But being able to do tangents and inverse tangents is very handy. You got it, Mel.
Questions for Mel, WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Mel, okay, so to give the polar answer, from what I see, you do have to include the 36.87 as an answer. Because I'm just reversing this 3-4-5 right triangle, making the horizontal 3 and the vertical 4, you still come up with a 50 ohm answer, in other words, 130 and the other one's 40, you're still going to come up with a 50 ohm answer, but this 36.87 number would change, so you just can't give an answer of 50 ohms, is that correct?
It would be 53.1, just like Howie was saying. You reverse the 30 and the 40, and if you use the resistance as a reference, resistance line as a reference, you'll come up with 53 degrees. By the way, 53 degrees and 36 degrees are complements of each other. Add them together, they always equal 90. You got it, Mel.
Right, okay. I don't want to confuse anybody. I don't want to get into that. But normally you would say that if you were reading 40 plus J30 in rectangular form and you convert it directly to polar form, with using resistance as your horizontal drawing it classically as they teach it, they show you always the horizontal line as the R and the line going vertically as your reactance. That's the way I've seen it most of the books. So that's why I stuck to this. Another question I was asked, if I'm at my antenna and I'm reading the R and the X on the noise bridge. Can I convert that with my handheld calculator easy over to read FWR? Now, I know of a method, one method, using the quadratic method. I thought maybe I would give that as the simplest method, Dick. What do you think, over?
Yeah, this is going to give people a little bit more trouble. In order to be able to see what's going on, you can either go into a great big complicated formula, which is a little hard to remember, or you can do it as a two-step process. If you know the real R and X of something, your antenna, an amplifier, whatever, somebody has told you how much resistive component is its impedance and how much reactive component, and hopefully they told you it was a positive or negative reactance. Sometimes you don't have to know that. The way you calculate the first step is, what is the reflection coefficient? You know from experience that if the antenna, for instance, was a 50-ohm antenna, all the power going down a 50-ohm coax transmission line would go into that antenna, get radiated by the antenna, and none would reflect. So in that case, your reflection coefficient would be 0.0. You take your formula in the form that Hewlett-Packard does it, open parentheses, 50, comma, 36, well that was in the polar form, 40, comma, 30, and that is your impedance, call that Z, it's a complex impedance, and now you're going to write that impedance down twice. Once above the numerator and once below the numerator. You're going to make a fraction. So open parentheses 40 comma 30 is the Z. One of the most universal formulas that's worth memorizing is reflection coefficient equals Z minus 50 on top over Z plus 50 on the bottom. So you do that, you get the exact answer, but it's in a peculiar form. You got to do some work with it. You could then take an absolute value of that and find out when it comes to standing wave ratio, you don't have to know the phase angle. It turns out that that formula, Z minus 50 over Z plus 50, not only does it tell you the magnitude of the reflection coefficient, believe it or not, it tells you the phase angle. It tells you the signal it reflects off the antenna. What phase angle is it coming back? And you can convert that into an absolute number of reflection coefficient. And now VISWAR equals S minus 1 over S plus 1. I got it backwards. 1 minus S over 1 plus S, where S is the reflection. I should have said rho. Here we go. 1 minus rho over 1 plus rho is standing wave ratio. So I've broken it up into a two-step process. Some people would rather do it as one complete formula. Maybe you do it that way, Mel. And so tell us your favorite way. K2KUI. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, I'm going to do it a fairly simple way. This is K2KUI. All right, let's take the previous measurement we made, 40 plus J30. Now, I'm going to give you a formula. FWR is equal to B for boy, B plus the square root of B squared minus 4 and the whole thing divided by 2. Okay, again, I'll say it. FWR is equal to B plus the square root of B squared minus 4 over 2. Now, we have to solve for B first. Now, we're doing this, remember, with a handheld, we're up by the antenna, we'd like to get our FWR right there. That 40 plus J30, as we've done in the past, we've normalized it when we plotted it on a Smith chart, if you remember, by dividing it by 50. So, we do that again, we're going to normalize it, and we get 0.8 plus J.6 by dividing it by 50. So now we need to solve for B. B, I'm going to give you another little simple formula. B equals bracket plus R over, no, excuse me, J squared, and let me start all over again, get my head straight. B equals bracket J squared plus 1 divided by R, close bracket, plus R. Again, I'll do it again. B equals J squared plus 1 over R. This is bracketed on both sides, plus R. Again, J squared plus 1 over R, close the brackets, in other words, it's in a bracket, plus R. So if we solve for B, again, I hope I didn't confuse anybody, if we take our J, which we normalize to 0.6, we get 0.6 squared plus 1 divided by R, which is our resistance, is 0.8, plus 0.8. So if we solve in the bracket first, we're going to get 0.36 plus 1 divided by 0.8. That was plus 0.8. Now, the next step we'll have, when we solve what's inside the bracket, we'll have 1.36 divided by 0.8 plus 0.8. And that'll yield us 1.7 plus 0.8, which will equal to 250. I did it step by step, so I'm sure if you're recording it there, you can go back and refer to it. I know a number of people said they like to do it that way so they can practice with it. So B will equal to 250. Now, substituting that, now back in our quadratic equation, we had SWR is equal to B plus the square root of B squared minus 4 divided by 2. We're going to substitute now what we just we got B equal to 250. So we have 250 plus the square root of 2.50. I should say 250. I should say 2.50. I'm sorry. I hope I didn't confuse everybody. It's 2.50. Plus, again, I'll start all over. SWR is equal to 2.50 plus the square root of 2.50 squared minus 4 divided by 2. And that will equal to 2.50 plus square root of 2.25 divided by whole thing divided by 2. The next step, you'll have 2.50. The square root will come out to 1.50 divided by 2. So we add the 2.50 and 1.50. We're going to get 4.00. And it's divided by 2, the whole thing. Our SWR is going to equal to 2.00 in this case. I hope I went slow enough on this method, Dick. Over.
Yes, I think so. And I'm going to check the mathematics while I sit and listen.
Okay, I just figured it's a simple way of doing it with a simple handheld calculator. No fancy math. It's basically, you know, quadratic algebra, straightforward algebra, easy to understand each step of the way. So I hope that helps people. So this is by taking our rectangular measurement of 40 plus 30, J30, with our noise bridge, we can very simply in a couple of seconds, couple minutes or so, while you're up there at the antenna and all, want to make adjustments so you can visualize what your SWR is. This is a method that I'm sure you can easily apply to get that result. K2RIW in the TechNet, K2K.
Yeah, Hewlett-Packard gave me not 2.0, 1.999999, obviously 2.0, yes. And so, yeah, VisWar from a known impedance. Mel did it by a formula, which I consider a two-step process. I do it by a slightly different procedure, which again is a two-step process. He does it by calculating something called B, which is related to reflection coefficient, but it is not reflection coefficient. I do it by a method that gives me the reflection coefficient, and then I use that as a rho. That's what reflection coefficient is usually represented as, the Greek letter rho. Everyone has set that one aside for that function, just like pi is, you know,